I don't think a judge should be keeping a scorecard about how many times the judge votes for one category of litigant versus another in particular types of cases. That would be wrong. We're supposed to do justice on an individual basis in the cases that come before us. But I think that if anybody looks at the categories of – looks at the cases that I've voted on in any of the categories of cases that have been cited, they will see that there are decisions on both sides. In every type of employment discrimination case, for example, there are decisions on both sides.
Well, most employment discrimination cases really are decided at the lower level.
Most of them are,
and
yes.
When they get up to your level, it's generally decided on technical or procedural basis. Am I wrong in that?
No, that's correct, Senator.
And sometimes you have to uphold the law, even though you may be uncomfortable with the law yourself.
We have to decide the cases on the facts that are in the record and the law that applies.
Well, that's right. Well, let me just give you a couple of ask you about a few of your cases, because you know it's easy to cherry pick these cases and find a sentence here you don't like and a sentence there you don't like and criticize you for in the process as though you're not being fair, when in fact everybody who knows you knows your impeccable reputation for fairness, dignity, decency and honor, and capacity. And that's why you got the highest rating from the American Bar Association and deserve it. And you've twice got that. And I know how tough they can be. But let me just give you a couple of illustrations. Zubi v. AT&T. You were the lone dissenter in that case. What did you dissent from?
I dissented from a majority decision that held that Mr. Zubi, who was claiming racial discrimination, would not have his day in court because of the statute.
Who would have given him his day in court, right?
I would have,
if it had been up to you.
Yes.
All right. How about U.S. versus Kithcart? I don't expect you to remember all these cases, but and if you don't, just raise your hand and I'll try and recite them. But this was a Fourth Amendment case. You held that the Fourth Amendment does not allow police to target drivers because of the color of their skin. Is that right?
That's right. That was essentially a case of racial profiling, and I wrote an opinion holding that that was a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
And that was even after a police officer received a report that two black men in a black sports car had committed three robberies. And she pulled over the first black man in a black sports car, the first black sports car she saw. But you ruled against the defendant, or ruled for the defendant and against racial profiling in that case.
That's correct, Senator.
Okay, and Thomas versus Commissioner of Social Security. Just to mention a few of these cases to show that you're going to do what's right, regardless. And sometimes in these employment cases and even other cases, when you get up on appeal, they're fairly technical in nature, and you've got to do what's right under the law. But in Thomas versus Commissioner of Social Security, do you recall that case?
I do.
What'd you
yes.
do there?
Well, that was the case where I think the Supreme Court thought that my opinion had gone too far in favor of the little guy who was involved there.
This was a woman with disabilities, right?
That's right, a woman who was trying to get
Social Security benefits. And she sought Social Security benefits.
Social Security disability benefits. And in order to be eligible for those, she had to be unable to perform any job that existed in substantial numbers in the national economy.
She had a job as an elevator operator, if I recall.
That's right. As the case was presented to us, the only job that she could perform was her past job, which was as an elevator operator. And what I said was that you can't deny somebody Social Security benefits because the person is able to do a job that no longer exists in any substantial numbers in the national economy. You can't deny benefits based on a hypothetical job. It has to be based on a real job. And the Supreme Court didn't see it that way, but it seemed to me that the way that we ruled was consistent with what I thought.
In other words, although you stood up for the person seeking rights here, the Supreme Court overruled you.
That's right.
Oh, my goodness. In the landmark case of, how do you pronounce it, Fatton v. INS?
Fatton, I think.
Well, this involved an Iranian woman, Iranian women who refused to conform to their government's gender-specific laws and social norms, whether or not they should be granted asylum in America. How did you rule in that case?
I think that was one of the first cases in the federal courts to hold that requiring a woman to be returned to a country where she would have to wear a veil and conform to other practices like that would amount to persecution if that was deeply offensive to her, and that subjecting a woman to persecution in Iran or any other country to which she would be returned based on feminism would be persecution on the basis of political opinion.
Well, I've got another 9 or 10 cases and perhaps even more that I could go through, but the point is that whenever they deserve to win, they win, regardless of whether they're rich or poor, whether they're powerful or not. You've basically upheld the law in these cases. Is that correct?
That is what I've tried to do.
And where you've been in dissent, you've tried to do it to the best of your abilities.
That's right, Senator.
Okay. Let me just mention one other thing. I think you've got this business of the Vanguard. When you signed that back in 1990, 12 years before the matter for which you're being criticized, not by anybody who has any ethical, professorial, or other knowledge, not by the American Bar Association, not by the vast majority of lawyers who look at these matters, that particular statement said, "Will you, during your, quote, initial service," unquote. Seems to me those are important words. Now, you haven't tried to hide behind that. You've just honestly explained that basically you made a mistake, which really wasn't a mistake according to all the ethics people and according to the American Bar Association. And now, instead of the original accusation and the original implication, you're being accused of not being forthcoming because of that original statement in your application for to the committee questionnaire. But the fact of the matter is that, quote, initial service doesn't mean 12 years away, does it? When there's no chance in the world that you could ever have received any monetary benefit from Vanguard.
Well, I don't think initial service means 12 years away.
Neither do I, and neither does anybody who cares about justice and about what's right in this matter. So to blow that out of proportion like your adversaries have done is really pretty offensive. I could go on and on, but be stronger on that, but the fact of the matter is I just wanted to make that initial service, unquote, pretty clear. Now, let me just say that sometimes I just can't make sense out of what some of your critics are saying. On the one hand, they want to portray you as some sort of a robotic patsy for big government who does not think for himself. Yesterday, one of my Democratic colleagues even suggested that the Bush administration was trying to manipulate you to give responses favorable to them in this hearing. Now, you quite rightly said, and I think you were fairly restrained about saying it, that you've been a judge for 15 years and are quite capable of thinking for yourself. On the other hand, then, your critics then turn it around and attack you for supposedly dissenting too much, as if you should actually stop doing all that thinking for yourself and just fall in line with the majority in all of your cases. Now, Judge, I know that appeals court judges, that the appeals courts themselves are collegial bodies, but how do you view dissenting from your colleagues? How do you decide when to do it? How do you know how often you dissent in your court and or do you know how often you dissent in your court and whether it's out of step with your colleagues? Could you give us some answers there?
Yes. I think that it's important for a multi-member court to issue a judgment and to speak clearly to the lower courts and the parties. And so when I've been in a position where taking an independent position would result in the absence of a judgment, I have gone out of my way to make sure that there was a judgment, that there was a majority opinion. And an example of that is the Rapa case, where we were really divided three ways. And my position was close to the to Judge Becker's opinion, and Judge Becker had the opinion writing assignment. And I issued an opinion saying I don't completely agree with the way Judge Becker analyzed this issue. I would analyze it differently, but I'm joining his opinion so that there is a majority opinion so that there is a clear statement of the law for the guidance of the parties. I think that's the first principle. A second is that judges should be respectful of each other's views, and I don't have any I have tried never to write a dissenting opinion or respond in a majority opinion to a dissenting opinion in a way that was not completely respectful of the views of the other members of the court. It's useful to dissent if there's a chance that the case may go en banc, and that's happened in a number of cases where I've dissented. It's useful to dissent if there is a chance that the case may go to the Supreme Court, and so that the Supreme Court will have the benefit of a different expression of views, and there have been cases.
Would it surprise you to know that you've dissented only 79 times in nearly 5,000 cases in which you've participated? That comes out to about 1.6%, which is considerably lower than most others who have been on the appellate courts. And I would observe that the Washington Post concluded in an editorial that your dissenting opinions, quote, are the work of a serious and scholarly judge whose arguments deserve respect, unquote. I certainly agree wholeheartedly with that assessment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hatch. Senator Kennedy.
Edward Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts.
Mr. Chairman, Judge Alito, I hadn't planned to get into Vanguard on this particular round, but I chaired those hearings when you were promoted to the Circuit Court, and I was also the one that filed those questions, which you responded to. And you responded as, under oath when you promised the committee that you would recuse yourself on Vanguard issues. Now I'm just hearing from you that you believe that that pledge was somehow conditioned. I'm unlike my friend, and he is my friend from Iowa, that says, well, a pledge is just a pledge. It's like any political pledge. It is around here. It's a political promise and doesn't carry much weight. That's not my opinion, and I don't think it is the opinion of most of the members of this body. You made a pledge to the Senate, effectively, to the American people, that you're going to recuse yourself. Now you say, well, it was just for an initial time, and I think 12 years is more than I really had in mind, or you just qualified your answer. How long, when you made that pledge and that promise to the committee, how long did you intend to keep it?
Well,
and
Senator,
did when that time was up, did you ever imagine that you might get back to the committee and said, I believe my time is up on Vanguard?
Well, Senator, the statement that I The nature of the question that I was responding to did not figure in the way the Manga case was handled, and I thought I made that clear yesterday. I was following throughout my time on the bench the practice of going beyond the code, and had I focused on this issue when the matter came before me, I would have recused myself at that time, as I later did. But in answer to Senator Hatch's question, looking at that question today and looking at the answer, the question was, what do you intend to do during your initial period of service? And I think that that's what the answer has to be read as responding to. But let me just to be clear, that was not – I'm not saying that that's why this played out the way it did. I'm just saying that's how I think the question and the answer – that's how I think the question and any response to the answer by any nominee needs to be interpreted.
Well, if there's someone that can just understand what you just told us, I'd be interested in it, because I don't.
Well, I'll be glad to explain it.
If Mr. Chairman, you, are, in response to Senator Hatch, did not believe that you were bound by the promise, because you said in your mind, you felt that it was just for the initial aspects of it. That's another issue, because initially was meant to include the investments that you had at that particular time. You might have those investments and then discard an investment and therefore no longer have a conflict. That is what, as the asker of the question had intended. But you've added another wrinkle to it. You've just indicated that when you made a pledge to the committee that you were going to recuse yourself, that you thought that at some time you were going to be released. And I'd just like to know, how long that was going to be? Was that going to be 2 years? Was it going to be 3 years? Was it going to be 5 years? When did you feel that you were going to be released?
Well,
if we followed your interpretation.
Senator, I did not rely on that time limitation in relation to what I did in the Manga case. And I hope I've made that clear. If I didn't in my previous answer, I do want to make it clear. I did not rely on that in my handling of the Manga case. Looking at the question now, where it says initial period of service, I would say that 12 years later is not the initial period of service, but that was not...
When did it stop then? When did you think that your pledge to the committee halted? After how many years? 6 months?
Well, Senator,
what did you intend at the time that you made the pledge? What was in your mind at that time? I'm interested in what was in your mind at this time?
I can't specifically recall what was in my mind at that time, but I'll tell you what I'm pretty sure I had in mind. I was not a judge, and I was being considered for a judicial position, and what I was trying to express was basically the policy that I followed during all my years on the bench, which is to bend over backwards to make sure that I didn't do anything that came close to violating the code of conduct or give anybody the impression that I was doing anything that was improper.
My last question on this is, how long then, when you made the promise under oath to the committee that you were going to recuse yourself, and you understand that now to be in your own interpretation just to be the initial time, how long did you think that that pledge and promise lasted?
Senator, as I said, I can't tell you 15 years later exactly what I thought when I read that question. It refers to the initial period of service, and looking at it now, it doesn't seem to me that 12 years later is the initial period of service.
Well, my question to you, which I guess I'm not going to get an answer to, is when did it? Is 10 years? Is how about 3 years? Is that?
Well, I don't know exactly what the time limitation would be, but 12 years does seem to me not to be the initial period.
We'll come back. I just want to mention, in fairness to my friend and colleague, both my friends, Senator Hatchett, Senator Durbin, and Senator Hatch's quoting of Senator Durbin that you responded on the question of the Roe v. Wade in the when you were the circuit court. I have here the record that said of the hearings of Roberts. And the question was asked by Senator Specter to Judge Roberts during the time of his consideration for the Supreme Court. So I want that to be – Senator Durbin can clarify the record, but I wanted that to be clarified so that there wasn't a confusion about it. Now, in the time that I have, Judge Alito, I listen carefully to – responses that you gave to Senator Leahy about the CAP organization at Princeton. And I listened to other responses that you gave to our colleagues, and again to Senator Durbin earlier today. But I have just some questions on this to at least try to finalize, at least in my mind, and it might be useful in the committee's mind as well. You had indicated in your 85 job application that you're a member of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy and a regular participation at its luncheon, and a member of the Concerned Alumni of Princeton University, a conservative alumni group. And you said yesterday that you racked your memory about the issue and really had no specific recollection of the organization. Is that correct?
I had no specific recollection of joining the organization.
And you also said yesterday and today to Senator Durbin that you very likely joined CAP because of your concern over the ROTC program being kicked off campus. Is that correct?
Well, what I said specifically was that I racked my memory as to why I might have joined, and the issue that had bothered me for a period of time as an undergraduate and in the 80s, around the time of this, when I made the statement, was the issue of ROTC. This was the issue about the administration of Princeton that bothered me. I had a high regard for Princeton in many respects in general, and have participated in a lot of their activities. But this issue bothered me a great deal at various times, and that's what I said.
And finally, you said yesterday that you very likely joined CAP around 1985, just before you were applying to the high-level job in the Justice Department under President Ronald Reagan. I think that's correct.
Senator, what I specifically said, as I recall, is that if I had done anything substantial in relation to this group, including renewing my membership, I would remember that, right. And I do not remember that.
So I want to ask a few things that I hope can clear this up. You have no memory of being a member. You graduated from Princeton in 1972, the same year CAP was founded. You call CAP a conservative alumni group. It also published a publication called Prospect, which includes articles by CAP members about the policies and the that the organization promoted. You're familiar with that?
I don't recall seeing the magazine. I
Did
might
you know
have
seen that they some had
point.
A magazine?
I've learned of that in recent weeks.
So a 1983 Prospect essay titled In Defense of Elitism stated, quote, "People nowadays just don't seem to know their place. Everywhere one turns, blacks and Hispanics are demanding jobs simply because they're black and Hispanic. The physically handicapped are trying to gain equal representation in professional sports, and homosexuals are demanding that government vouchsafe them the right to bear children." So, did you read that article?
Finish the last line.
Finish the last line is, and homosexuals are...
And now, here come women.
If the senator, let me just... can I get two more minutes from my friend? Just to continue along, I apologize, Judge. Did you read this article?
I feel confident that I didn't. I'm not familiar with the article, and I don't know the context in which those things were said, but they are antithetical.
But could you think of any context that they could be?
Hard to imagine. If that's what anybody was endorsing, I disagree with all of that. I would never endorse it. I never have endorsed it. Had I thought that that's what this organization stood for, I would never associate myself with it in any way.
The June 84 edition of Prospect magazine contains a short article on AIDS. I know that we've come a long way since then in our understanding of the disease, but even for that time, the insensitivity of statements in this article are breathtaking. It announces that a team of doctors has found that AIDS virus in the rhesus monkeys was similar to the virus occurring in human beings, and the article then goes on with this terrible statement. Now the scientists must find humans, or rather homosexuals, to submit themselves to experimental treatment. Perhaps the gay Princeton's Gay Alliance may want to hold an election. You didn't read that article.
I feel confident that I didn't, Senator, because I would not have anything to do with statements of that nature.
In 1973, a year after you graduated and during your first year at Yale Law School, former Senator Bill Bradley very publicly disassociated himself with CAP because of its right-wing views and unsupported allegations about the university. His letter of resignation was published in The Prospect, garnered much attention on campus and among the alumni. Were you aware at the time at the time that you listed the organization in your application?
I don't think I was aware of that until recent weeks when I was informed of it.
And in 1974, an alumni panel, including now Senator Frist, unanimously concluded that CAP had presented a distorted, narrow, hostile view of the university. Were you aware of that at the time of the job application?
I was not aware of it until very recently.
In 1980, the New York Times article about the co-education of Princeton, CAP is described as an organization against the admittance of women. In 1980, you were working as an assistant U.S. attorney in Trenton, New Jersey. Did you read the New York Times? Did you see this article?
I don't believe that I saw the article.
And did you read a letter from CAP mailed in 1984? This is the year before put CAP on your application, to every living alumni, living alumni. So I assume you received it, which declared, "Princeton is no longer the university you knew it to be," as evidence, among other reasons. It cited the fact that admission rates for African Americans and Hispanics were on the rise, while those of alumni children were failing, and Princeton's president at a time has urged that the then all-male eating clubs to admit of females. And in December 1984, President William Bowen responded by sending his own letter. This is the president of Princeton, responded by sending his own letter to all of the alumni, in which he called Cap's letter callous and outrageous. This letter was the subject of a January 1985 Wall Street Journal editorial congratulating President Bowen for engaging his critics in a free and open debate. This would be right about the time that you told Senator Kyle you probably joined the organization. Did you receive the Bowen letter, or did you read the Wall Street Journal, which was pretty familiar reading for certainly a lot of people that were in the Reagan administration?
Senator, I've testified to everything that I can recall relating to this, and I do not recall knowing any of these things about the organization, and many of the things that you've mentioned are things that I have always stood against. In your description of the letter that prompted President Bowen's letter, there's talk about returning the Princeton that used to be. There's talk about eating clubs, about all-male eating clubs. There's talked about the admission of alumni children. There's opposition to opening up the admissions process. None of that is something that I would identify with. I was not the son of an alumnus. I was not a member of an eating club. I was not a member of a eating facility that was selective. I was not a member of an all-male eating facility. And I would not have identified with any of that. If I had received any information at any point regarding any of the matters that you have referred to in relation to this organization, I would never have had anything to do with it.
Do you think that these are conservative views?
Senator, whatever I knew about this organization in 1985, I identified as conservative. I don't identify those views as conservative. What I do recall as an issue that bothered me in relation to the Princeton administration as an undergraduate and continuing into the 1980s was their treatment of the ROTC unit and their general attitude of toward the military, which they did not treat with the respect that I thought was deserving. The idea that it was beneath Princeton to have an ROTC unit on campus was an offensive idea to me.
Just moving on, you mentioned, and I only have a few minutes left, you joined CAP because of your concern about keeping ROTC on campus. Now, ROTC was a fairly contentious issue on Princeton campus in the early 70s. The program was slated to be terminated in 1970 when you were an undergraduate. By 1973, 1 year after you graduated, ROTC had returned to campus and was no longer a source of debate. And from what I can tell, by 1985, it was basically a dead issue. In fact, my staff reviewed the additions of prospects from 1983 to 85 and could find only one mention of ROTC, and it appears in a 1985 issue released for homecoming that year that says, ROTC is popular once again. Here is the prospect. 1985, ROTC is popular again. This was just about the time that you were submitting this organization in your job application.
Senator, I'm sorry.
No, but briefly, if please.
It's my recollection that this was a continuing source of controversy. There were people on the campus who, members of the faculty, as I recall, who wanted the unit removed from the campus. There was certainly controversy about whether students could get credit for courses, which I believe was a military requirement for the maintenance of the unit. There was controversy, as I recall, about the status of the instructors, whether they could be given any kind of a status in relation to the faculty. I don't know the exact dates, but it's my recollection that this was a continuing source of controversy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I my time is running out. I had wanted to just wind up on a few more brief questions on this, but I have to say that Judge Alito, that his explanations about the membership in this sort of radical group and why you listed it on your job application are extremely troubling. And in fact, I don't think that they add up. Last month, I sent a letter to Senator Specter asking a number of questions about your membership in CAP. And I asked Senator Specter to make a formal committee request for the documents in the possession of the Library of Congress as part of the William Rusher papers. Mr. Rusher was the publisher of the National Review, was an active founder and leader of CAP. Do you have any hesitancy or reason for us not to look at those documents?
They're not my documents, Senator, and I have no...
You think they would be helpful
about
to us?
It whatsoever.
You think they'd be helpful?
As Senator, I don't believe I had any active member, any active involvement with this group.
Well,
I've racked my memory, and I can't recall anything. And if I had been involved actively in any way in the group, I'm sure that I would remember.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could have your attention, I think we ought to vote on issuing a subpoena to the custodian of those CAP records. And I want to do that at an appropriate time. I'd move that the committee go into executive session for the purpose of voting on the issuing of the sole purpose for issuing the subpoena of those records.
Well, we'll consider that, Senator Kennedy.
Well,
there are many requests which are coming to me in many quarters, and quite candidly, I view the requests. If it's really a matter of importance, you and I see each other all the time. You've never mentioned it to me. And I do not ascribe a great deal of weight. We actually didn't get a letter, but...
You did get a letter, are you saying?
Well, now, wait a minute. You don't know what I got. I'm about to...
Of course I do, sir, Senator, since I sent it.
Well, the sender doesn't necessarily know what the recipient gets, Senator Kennedy.
I've got it right
here. You are not in the position to... say what I receive. If you'll bear with me for just 1 minute.
But I am in a position to say what I sent to you on December 22nd.
Well, you're
so
in a position,
I renew
you're,
my,
you're in a position to tell me what
I,
you sent.
I renew my request, Senator, and if I'm going to be denied, then I'd appeal the decision of the chair. I think we are entitled to this information. It deals with the fundamental issues of equality and discrimination. This nominee has indicated he has no objection to us seeing these issues. We've gone over the questions, and we are entitled to get that kind of information. And if you're going to rule it out of order, I want to have a vote on that here on our committee.
Well, don't be premature, Senator Kennedy. I'm not about to make a ruling on this state of the record. I hope you won't mind if I consider it, and I hope you won't mind if I give you the specifics that there was no letter which I received. I take umbrage that you're telling me what I received. I don't mind you're telling me what you mailed. But there's a big difference between what's mailed and what's received, and you know that. We're going to move on now.
Well, Senator Grassley, Mr. Chairman, I'd appeal the ruling of the chair on this.
There's been no ruling of the chair, Senator Kennedy.
Well, what is my request is that we go into the executive session for the sole purpose voting on a subpoena for these records that are held over at the Library of Congress for that purpose and that purpose only. And if
well,
I'm going to be denied that, I'd want to give notice to the chair that you're going to have it again and again and again, and we're going to have votes of this committee again and again and again until we have a resolution.
Senator Kennedy, I'm not concerned about your threats to have votes again, again, and again. And I'm the chairman of this committee, and I have heard your request, and I will consider it. And I'm not going to have you run this committee and decide when we're going to go into executive session. We're in the middle of a round of hearings. This is the first time you have personally called it to my attention, and this is the first time that I have focused on it. And I will consider it in due course. And now we'll move to Senator Grassley for 20 minutes.
Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa.
Well, we've gone over the same ground many times. I suppose maybe to some extent both sides are guilty of that. But we have an old saying in the Midwest about if a horse is dead, quit beating it. And I think several horses have been beaten to death, particularly on the other side. And you've been very consistent in your answers. And I thank you And I think that that speaks to the intellectual honesty of your positions. It's kind of like we're in the fourth quarter of a football game, and you're the quarterback, and your team is way ahead here in the fourth quarter, and opponents are very desperate, trying to sack you and aren't doing a very good job of it, and they haven't hit you all day, now for 2 days, and you're going to keep getting these last minute Hail Marys thrown at you, so just to bear with us. I want to compliment you, first of all, before I ask some questions, and I just did to some extent about the consistency of your testimony, but I think it's been good. I think under very difficult circumstances, you've handled yourself very well, being responsive, forthright, thoughtful. I sense in you a person that's very sincere, and obviously I don't know you except this appearance here in the small period of time we spent in our office. Seems like you have modesty that's a breath of fresh air, demonstrating a command of and very much a respect for the law and the Constitution, of course. And this is all stuff that we ought to be looking for in the tradition of Alexander Hamilton saying the role of the court or the Senate is to make sure that only competent people get on the court and that political hacks don't get on the court. And you're surely no political hack, and you're very competent, and that's been demonstrated with your fair and open-minded approach to your being a judicial person. It's too bad that we're getting this misconstruing of your record or the answers, the claim that you've not written a single opinion on the merits in favor of a person of color alleging race discrimination on the job in your 15 years on the bench. I've looked at a lot of opinions you've given, and it's just not true. Your record shows that you ruled in favor of minorities, making allegations of racial discrimination in employment, not once, but a number of cases. The claim that you acted unethically in the Vanguard case is just not true. You did nothing improper and actually went beyond the rule to ensure compliance. The claim that you would support an unchecked executive is just not true. Your record shows that you've repeatedly ruled against the government and that you've told us no one, including the president, is above the law. The claim that you've ruled in vast majority of time against the claims of individual citizens in favor of the government and large corporations is just not true. The reality, as I see it, that you found in favor of the little guy in numerous cases, but because of who was right and who was wrong, not just because you got a bias one way or the other. Your critics are, I think, grasping at any straw to tarnish your record, and that's unfortunate. Judge Alito, in your opening statement, you said, and I hope I quote you accurately, no person in this country, no matter how high or powerful, is above the law, and no person in this country is beneath the law. You didn't go into detail about what you meant. I think it's quite clear above the law, but give us that diverse opinion, above the law versus beneath the law.
Every person has equal rights under the law in this country, and that involves people who have no money, that includes people who have no money, that includes people who do not hold any high or prestigious position, it includes people who are citizens and people who are not citizens. Everybody is entitled to be treated equally under the law. And so, and I think that's one of the greatest things about our country and about our legal system.
You've been criticized for being hostile to voting rights based upon a statement that you wrote 20 years ago when you were applying for a job with the Justice Department during the Reagan years. In fact, yesterday, some of my colleagues repeated that assertion, but it's apparently to me that it's off the mark. Specifically, in your 85 statement, you wrote that you became interested in constitutional law and went to law school in part because you had some disagreements over Warren Court decisions, including some regarding reapportionment. Of course, that's understandable because the Warren Court had handed down very many decisions on reapportionment, and they had been criticized as unworkable, and that, in fact, the Supreme Court backed away from some. So there was disagreement. There was debate over those issues at that time, probably a lot less today, but still recently there's going to be a case going to the court. Some have questioned your 1985 statement regarding electoral reapportionment, that is, how districts are drawn. They suggested that you're hostile to the principle of one person, one vote. Clarify for me, nowhere in your 85 statement did I find that you wrote that you ever disagreed with the principle of one person, one vote, did you?
I never disagreed with that principle, Senator. What I disagreed with when I was in college was the application of the principle in some of the elaboration of the principle in some of the late Warren Court decisions. And this grew out of my father's work with the New Jersey legislature. He had been the secretary to the State Constitutional Convention of 1966, which redrew the provisions of the state constitution relating to the composition of the legislature in an effort to bring it into compliance with the one-person, one-vote standard. These provisions, however, because they tried to respect county and municipal lines, as I recall, resulted in population deviations of under 10%, but those deviations were much higher than the ones that the Supreme Court said in the late decisions that I'm talking about would be tolerated regarding congressional districts. There was a belief that that principle would be applied across the board, both to congressional districts and to legislative districts, and that would have wiped out the plan that had been adopted. And I was quite familiar with all of this, and it seemed to me an instance of taking a good principle, which is one person, one vote, and taking it to extremes, requiring that districts be exactly equal in population, which did not seem to me to be a sensible idea.
Isn't it true that the statement or the words one person, one vote weren't even in your statement?
Those words are not in my statement.
Senator,
that this issue of how nearly exact the districts had to be was an issue that was working its way to the Supreme Court, or maybe it had actually been there. I've forgotten the exact chronology. At the time of the 1985 statement in Karcher versus Daggett, which involved the New Jersey Congressional Districting Plan.
Well, just to make sure that there's no lingering confusion then, let me ask you straight out, do you believe in the principle of one person, one vote?
I do. I think it's a fundamental part of our constitutional law.
I find it curious that the same people who are questioning your integrity are either asserting or implying that you took a position against the principle one man or one person, one vote, when it is demonstrably false that you ever did. Further, on another point, some have suggested that you're hostile to women and minorities. Obviously, I don't think that's the case. I think you demonstrated that sincerity in just very recent statements today. Now, in the Washington Post article, there was an Alberto Rivas, a criminal defense lawyer and a Democrat, said you, quote, took steps to diversify an office. This was when you were U.S. attorney. You took steps to diversify an office that had a reputation as something of a white boys' club. Rivas said that when you hired him at the U.S. Attorney's Office, New Jersey, he was the only Latino lawyer in the office, and by the time you left that office, Rivas said there was four Latino lawyers as well as African-American lawyers. Your commitment also included advancing women attorneys and promoting them into senior positions during your tenure as U.S. attorney, and I understand that when you stated or started in that office, only two of the 15 divisional leadership attorneys, chiefs or deputy chiefs or attorneys in charge, were women, and 2 years later, you had more than double that number, and five of the 17 divisional leadership attorneys were women. Now, on the federal bench, you've hired many women and minorities to serve as law clerks, and you had a discussion with Senator Brownback earlier, mentioning some very complimentary things that Kathy Fleming, your former deputy chief and acting chief of special prosecutions units in the New Jersey office, and David Walk, a former lawyer in that office, had to say about you and your treatment of women and minorities. They both, being lifelong Democrats, vouched in those statements for your qualities as a judge and your respect for individual rights. And, Mr. Chairman, if these letters, and they may have already been put in the record, but if they aren't in the record, I'd like to have those put in the record.
Without objection, yeah. They will be made a part of the record.
Yeah. Several of your dissents have been referred to today, or not in the last 2 days, and so I wanted to comment on this suggestion that you're way out of the mainstream because you've written a lot of dissenting opinions. I don't find that you've written so many as a percentage of your total thing, but whatever reason you did it with good reason. But judges disagree all the time. And that's to be expected, and obviously there's nothing wrong with that. And, in fact, the Supreme Court has agreed with your dissents on several occasions, I recall from reading synopsis of your opinions. And the reality is, as I see it, you don't disagree with majority opinions more frequently than most federal appeals judges do in similar cases. And of more than 4,800 cases, and that is an that we got from the Washington Post, but of more than 4,800 cases that you decided during your tenure on the Third Circuit, you dissented only in 79 cases, which would be only 1 6/10% of all those cases. So, I don't think that there's anything very extraordinary about the number of dissents or the dissents, and particularly when the Supreme Court has agreed with your opinion in reversing the Third Circuit. I'd like to go to the issue some historical basis for our constitutional law. The role of historical precedent in constitutional laws I find very interesting. For example, QI-TAM lawsuits have been a feature of Anglo-American law since the Middle Ages and have been a common feature of federal statutory law even since the first Congress. Yet their constitutionality has never been clearly adjudicated by the Supreme Court. What role does long-standing historical practice play in assessing the constitutionality of a government act or practice?
Well, it can be very relevant in many instances. One place where this has come up is when a statute was passed by the first Congress, and this has happened in a number of occasions. The first Congress, which was responsible for the Bill of Rights, passed a number of statutes relating to provisions of the Bill of Rights, and the Supreme Court has often looked to those and said, this is the same Congress that proposed the Bill of Rights, and they did this in enacting a statute, so that gives us a good indication of what they had in mind. And when there has been a legal practice that's existed for that predated the Constitution, then that certainly is relevant in considering its constitutionality.
I'd like to have you think about legislative history and how you might use it, or how often you might use it, or even how often, maybe if you got a rough quantifiable answer, how often you might use it. The Supreme Court, I think, has quite often stated legislative history of a particular bill would be critical in their interpretation of it. What's your position with respect to legislative history? How is it, how important is it to you, and how have you utilized history in interpreting statutes?
I have often looked to legislative history in the cases that I've written concerning statutory interpretation. And I think if anybody looks at those opinions, they will see that. When I interpret a statute, I do begin with the text of the statute. I think that certainly is the clearest indication of what Congress as a whole had in mind in passing the statute. And sometimes the language of the statute is dispositive, and it's really the decision can be made based on the language of the statute itself. But when there's an ambiguity in the statute, I think it's entirely legitimate to look to legislative history. And as I said, I have often done that. I think it needs to be done with caution. Just because one member of Congress said something on the floor, obviously that doesn't necessarily reflect the view of the majority who voted for the legislation. So it has to be done carefully, and I think with a realistic evaluation of the legislative process. But I'm not one of the judges who thinks that you should never look to legislative history. Okay. I think it has its place.
Are you familiar with the legal arguments that some opponents of the False Claims Act have made to the effect that its QI-TAM provisions are unconstitutional under Articles 2 and 3? And if you do, do you have any opinion on those arguments that are used without prejudicing any review of it you might give?
Well, the issue hasn't come up before me. I have a little bit of familiarity with the arguments. And I think that all I can say on the question is that the QI-TAM statute is of historical origin, as you pointed out. We have seen what it has produced in terms of tangible results in the cases that have been brought under the statute in recent years. And should an issue relating to its constitutionality come before me, either on the Third Circuit or the Supreme Court, then I would have to follow that whole judicial process that I've described and evaluate the arguments and certainly study the question much more thoroughly than I have done up to this point.
Yeah. You may have just answered this question, but I'd like to get it explicitly on the record. Have you ever written or spoken publicly about the issue of the constitutionality of QI-TAM or any other provision of False Claims Act, and if so, the circumstances and the context?
I'm quite sure I've never written or spoken about its constitutionality.
Do you feel that you have any bias against False Claims Act or whistleblower